All right, we're going to get started on our next proposition. I hope that everybody has enjoyed their lunch. This morning, when we had Senator Markey here, one of the things he did talk about was artificial intelligence, and it has come up several times today. So I'm very glad that we are going to be talking about in our next proposition. China is likely to be the leader of the coming artificial intelligence revolution. So while I introduce this proposition, I hope you will all pick up your clickers and vote. You need to turn it on. If your green light doesn't go on, raise your hand. That means your battery's dead on your clicker. And my staff has extras, and they would be happy to swap it out. Please vote. You're either voting for or against the proposition. Cutting-edge technologies, such as artificial intelligence, have the potential to reshape daily life and fundamentally change the global economy. To harness this potential, the Chinese government has outlined targets for development in artificial intelligence with the goal of making China a world leader in the field by 2030. The public and private sectors in China have already begun heavily investing in AI research and companies. In 2017, 48% of equity funding for AI startups globally came from China. Tech giants like Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu are already leading players in the field, both in terms of innovation and application. So today we have two terrific speakers to debate whether China will emerge as the leader in the coming era of AI. To my right, we have Dr. Edward Zhe, who's the founder and CEO of Gaofeng Advisory Company. To my left, Sam Sachs, who is a cybersecurity policy fellow at New America, and before that was with us in the science and technology program here at CSIS. And of course, you have their bios, with their longer bios in your programs. So before we lock in the votes, this is your last chance to vote. We have 43%. Say that 45% say that China is likely to be the leader of the coming artificial intelligence revolution, and 53% say no. And you know, that's pretty close. So we're going to see if our speakers can influence this debate and tilt it in their respective directions. But more importantly is to have an in-depth discussion about this issue, which is critically important to the United States, to China, and to the global economy. So with that, I think we will lock down the votes, and we will turn to Edward Zhe to give your remarks up at the podium. Thank you.
Hello? Can you hear me at the back? It's on, yes. Oh, right. Very good. Thank you very much, Bonnie, for inviting myself to be here. I'm very delighted to talk to you, in particular after lunch. I think that is great timing. I have to start by saying, Bonnie, that I may not actually agree with the in a way the topic or the title of what you put up.
You're not allowed to fight.
And I hope this is not too late. But I'll explain why. So artificial intelligence, let me start by just saying, you know, what's really working for China on artificial intelligence and why people like Bonnie or CSIS would put up this topic. And I know that it's not just Bonnie, this is a very much talked about topic here in the US. I think, you know, it's been talked about this morning by the senator and by a lot of people, you know, and it becoming a very interesting topic here in the US. And there must be a reason. I think the reason is because I think America does see China as a coming threat to its position as a leader or the leader in artificial intelligence. And there's probably some reason why that's the case. And I'll start by talking about why I believe that is probably the case. But at the same time, I also say towards the later part of my deliberation why I think America also have its edges, its own edges that in a way, in at least in the short term, you know, those edges will not be overcome or overtaken by China. So let me sort of provide the perspective in these two ways. I hope you don't mind. So what's working for China? Excuse me, sorry. In the last 40 years, since the start of the so-called reform and opening of China at the end of the Cultural Revolution, a lot has happened. I think a lot of speakers this morning talk about it. You've been reading, you know, you've been talking about it. You personally, many of you probably have participated in many of the events. And I think anybody can pick up anything about this period, about China and its relationship with the rest of the world, and really go and extract and talk a lot. In my view, my personal view is, having been working in China as a career strategy consultant for the last 25 years, and I myself as a Chinese, I think probably the most profound development in China in the last 40 years is the rise of the private sector in China. It's the rise of entrepreneurship in China. And in association with the rise of private sector is the rise of innovation in business, in particular in business innovation in China over this period of time. A lot has happened, a lot of changes. And today, as many of you know, that the private sector is the largest, compared to the state sector, is the larger, a much larger contributor to China's GDP, much larger contributor to the generation of new jobs, and so on and so forth. But more importantly, is the private sector, which has been embracing the emerging technologies, in particular over the last decade. And this decade is epitomized, ironically, by the invention of Americans, in particular by Apple, in particular by Steve Jobs. The wireless, the iPhone and the wireless internet has fundamentally changed China, as many of you know very well, and that has created a large number of tech-enabled innovations along the way. Along this period, China, as you know, has become the world's largest internet economy by numbers. Something like 800 million active users on the internet, and a lot of Chinese consumers, you know, they basically live the life on the internet, buying stuff, you know, eating stuff, and so on, social media, as you know the story. Why is that important? Because it sets the context about the so-called artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, along the way, it show up as another form of emerging technology, as you know. It applies to China, applies here in the US, applies to many other parts of the world. And the Chinese quickly say, well, you know, since in the last 10 years technology has served us well, why not? Something new is coming, why not embrace it? And by the way, AI is not the only new forms of technology that the Chinese embracing. It's also IoT, Internet of Things, is blockchain technology, and of course, as we discussed this morning, 5G is also just around the corner. Artificial intelligence has, or the Chinese embracement of the artificial intelligence have a number of inherent advantages. The inherent advantage is the scale of it. As I mentioned, China today, because of the evolution in the last decade, through the iPhone and the internet, wireless internet, has developed itself into the largest internet economy in the world. Vast number of data, for right or for wrong, is being generated every moment, every minute. Whenever we're on WeChat, we tell WeChat what we're doing. whenever we buy anything on Taobao or JD, we tell Alibaba and JD what we're doing. It's the same thing here in America with Facebook and Twitter and so on. It's just the same thing. But the difference is the scale. The scale makes it like, you know, it's like a strong feeding machine into the machine learning in artificial intelligence. As many of you know, perhaps from some of you, you know better than I do, is that artificial intelligence is really about a lot of iterations, a lot of learning, about powerful algorithms and a powerful microchips that can do the iterations many, many, many times in a short period of time, and hence you do the pattern recognition. And hence, the larger amount of data you have, the larger opportunity for the machine to learn and to fine-tune the pattern recognition, and therefore to yield perhaps better results from the standpoint of commercialization. China, for right or wrong, also have got themselves into or ourselves into a situation where data privacy is perhaps not as stringently applied or implemented as compared to many of the Western economies. Again, for right or wrong, that lack in the data privacy also feeds into this machine, that there's much less limitations for the machines to try to leverage the data and to try to learn. China fundamentally has a system advantage compared perhaps to many other countries in the world in this respect. It's not only about the scale of the market, but also not only about, as we discussed this morning, that the state, the central government, the state, the party, when they decide something, when one person decides something, that person push it all the way down to the whole country and everybody have to obey and so on. Maybe there's some of that. There's certainly the central government set up the targets, the plans. As Bonnie said, you know, there's an AI plan for 2030 that's made in China 2025, all sorts of plans. But it's just not today. It's how China has come along. There's 13 five-year plan. There's a lot of five-year plans. So, but that top-down is not the only thing that happens in China. It's also very much the grassroots level. The large number of entrepreneurs, the private sector people, who's really been popping up along the way, and they're coming up with all sorts of forms of innovation and so on. Yet in the middle, there's a lot of local governments, municipality government, city government, provincial government. A lot of them, what they want, when they see the central government coming with a new policy, they want to align themselves with the policy, yet at the same time, they want to create their own uniquely advantaged positions to their own advantages as well as the resources, and very oftentimes they work with the private sector to create the advantage position. So actually, it's a three-layer system. It's a three-layer paradigm with a dual economic structure. On one hand, you have the SOEs, and at the same time, you have the private sector that work together in a way, coexist together to create this resilient model. The Chinese didn't invent this. The Chinese didn't consciously design this. The Chinese accidentally fell into it, and they find somehow it's somewhat working, for right or for wrong. But this is only one part of the story. What I'm saying is that the Chinese, from the artificial intelligence standpoint, is doing pretty well in commercialization, in the commercial application of existing technology. And of course, the Chinese companies, in particular entrepreneurial companies, are also investing, some pretty significantly, into new ideas and AI and so on. But compared to the American companies, they're nothing. Nothing compared to the Googles, the Amazons, and the Microsoft of the world. And the gap is still very significant. I say the Americans are way ahead in terms of creativity, in terms of discovery, in terms of basic and original research, and the Chinese certainly would like to close the gap. But frankly, it's not like this. It doesn't happen that way. Over time, perhaps, and I think time will tell, and time will, actually. But at the same time, will it happen right away? Probably not. But will America be able to sort of be a peer of the Chinese on the commercial application? Not. You know, the American or any other markets is just not as big as China. And also, the privacy law is not as relaxed or lax as China, and therefore, that part, China has an advantage. This part, America has an advantage, and therefore, back to my original point of Bonnie, I think China is likely to be a leader in AI. Perhaps the leader on commercial applications, but it won't be the leader on original ideas. Thank you.
Right now, there is hysteria around China, and particularly around a so-called AI race with China. China is not necessarily going to dominate AI, and I'd like to make 5 points to flesh this out. China is great at writing national plans, but they are not so good at delivering on those plans. Let's just look at the past record on this. China has talked for years about having a globally competitive Chinese brand car, particularly in the electronic vehicle space. My colleague Scott Kennedy just wrote an excellent report looking at this issue. Do we have a Chinese Tesla that's out there competing in global markets? No. Let's look at the semiconductor industry. For years, the Chinese government has thrown billions of dollars at this sector, tons of policy. And yet last spring, when a ban on the Chinese telecom giant ZTE almost brought the banning it from US supply chains, this almost brought ZTE to its knees. So I would say that there are inherent limits to the state-led model that Dr. Ze has mentioned. For anyone who's spent time in China over the years, if you visit a state innovation zone or industrial park, are those leading to innovations? A lot of the times, those projects just go to fund lucrative real estate deals or politically favorable projects. So I think that there are inherent advantages to a market-led system in terms of adjusting to demand cycles, adopting quickly to new technologies. So let's not overestimate the importance of a national plan to be a driver of leadership in industry. Colleagues will say that AI will be different, and I'd like to question this. Why will AI be different? And here I'll make my following 4 points. Dr. Ze talked about data. This is a very popular talking point. China is the Saudi Arabia of data. But it's not just the volume of data. It's the quality of data. It is what kind of data. And I would argue that China may have a lot of Chinese data, but this is homogeneous data. Does that mean that China's going to get really good at figuring out what kind of news sites are Chinese consumers reading? What are Chinese teenagers buying? I think that they'll be excellent at developing products and services perfectly tailored to Chinese teenagers' tastes. But what is that going to mean for setting algorithms around the world? Then this leads to the question of, what are companies actually doing with that data, right? So it's the math that's put around the data that matters. How are companies utilizing the data? You know, companies like Tencent, which own WeChat, and Dr. Ze mentioned all of the data that's generated when people use the super app WeChat, both to purchase things, to talk to their friends. But companies like Tencent are notorious for having silos, even within the company, where they're not sharing that data, even within the company, right? So let's not get carried away with the data argument. And this leads me to my next point, which Dr. Ze also mentioned, and I think he's helped me make my case in some instances, so thank you for that, which is China lags in fundamental research, even if it excels in the business applications of that. And to Dr. Ze's point, yes, there is a tremendous culture of entrepreneurship right now. Which I think is really important to mention, right? It's not just the top-down model, but you do, in fact, have a bottom-up, grassroots, thriving entrepreneurship culture. But as colleagues such as Jeff Ding at Oxford have pointed out recently in an excellent foreign affairs piece, does this mean we're going to have profit-hungry entrepreneurs just simply aren't going to be pushing the envelope to the same extent as labs in the US that are just miles ahead on the core research that's involved? And so maybe you're going to have Chinese companies that are coming up with new applications of existing technologies. And I think here Dr. Zhou and I are in agreement. This leads me to my fourth point, which is on AI talent. And if you look at US universities and Chinese universities are making massive improvements, but there's still a long way to go in terms of meeting world-class university level that the US has. And the US is drawing from the best and brightest, not just in the US, but globally around the world. There are a lot of statistics out that compare AI talent in China and the US, and they all are essentially saying the same thing, which is there is a huge gap here. And this matters because talent shortage takes a long time to correct. This is not just something that's going to be course corrected over the next couple of years, but it's going to take a long time. And just to give you an example, Tencent had a recent study where they looked at AI experts, which they defined as scholars, practitioners, workers at leading startups, and they found that China had 13% of the world's AI talent in comparison to the US at 26%. But if you slice that even further, so you just look at the very cream of the crop, just look at PhDs, we're talking the experts that are involved in the core AI algorithms, not just people who may have led an AI project, that number gets even smaller, and China's at 1.9%, and the US is at over 40%, again, thanks to Jeff Ding for pointing out these numbers to me. So I think that that's a really important area we have to look at, and this will bring me to my fifth and final point, which is that China suffers from weakness in the core technologies under AI. And here I'd like to give a shout out to my colleague Paul Triolo, who actually was meant to be here today and is in Guangzhou at a summit right now where he is interacting with Chinese tech companies and VCs on this very issue. And Paul has done some great work looking at the fundamental weakness in the core technologies. So if we look at the AI stack and we think about semiconductors and hardware and then the software and the practical applications of AI. China does not have AI-optimized chips, and it is very unlikely that even in the near term they are going to. I talked before about the semiconductor plan, and this is a $150 billion national fund. But that fund has not focused on AI chips. And this is really going to be an insurmountable area where China's just not going to be able to catch up with the US or compete with the likes of NVIDIA or AMD in this area. So I'd like to close with three main points. You know, we talk a lot about entrepreneurship and data, and these are all sort of inputs into AI, but let's talk about the outputs. Until we see a Chinese company that can compete globally, not just on price because it's less expensive, but on the merits of its technology, where it's going toe-to-toe with the Googles and the Intels of the world, we're not going to see a truly dominant position in this space, no matter how much entrepreneurship you throw at it. I think that there is an impending AI bubble in China right now where you have huge investments and we have not seen much return so far. And my third and final point is it's only going to get worse because of some recent developments in the US. Some of you may have followed recently, the Commerce Department has come out with a list of emerging technologies that are going to be subject to tighter scrutiny on the export control list. AI features very prominently there, so it's going to be more difficult for China to access those technologies. Thinking about CFIUS reform and more scrutiny on Chinese companies acquiring that technology overseas from the US, right? So I would just caution, as we think about sort of China taking over the world with scary robots, let's take a more cautious and realistic approach. Thank you.
I've been both provoked and enlightened. And also, I think especially the last piece where it enlightened me by this unlikely scenario that you were going to see the Chinese-made robots. running around the world. I think the summit made quite a number of points. Because of the time limit, I have to pick, you know, what points that, you know, we want to talk about. So first of all, as I mentioned, you know, in my view at least, China will continue to drive on the commercial applications of artificial intelligence simply because of the size of the market and the vast amount of data. And through the algorithms and also with the existing, you know, very fast chips, which of course many of them is offered and supplied by American companies, but of course the Chinese trying to also make up the gap. I think we're going to see even more and more, sophistication that's come out as a result of this kind of iterations that happens almost every minute that we're now seeing. I think as like everything else in the world, and particularly in China, one cannot just take a snapshot and looking at what's happening today, and perhaps also not to extrapolate way too much from the past on a linear basis and try to make an extrapolation, and therefore that will be the likely scenario going forward. I think we are now also at another inflection point historically for the world, and in particular for China, because we have a number of major disruptive technologies evolving right at the same time, and it congregated right at, you know, at this moment or in the next few years in China. In my view, that's also going to be a game-changing kind of a move for the Chinese. A lot of them is going to be driven by the entrepreneurs, and Sam is correct. Not everybody is going to be successful in entrepreneurship, and why should they be? At the same time, some of them could. And China is a, you know, we all know that it's a big market. A lot of people are trying, a lot of young people, by the way, the post-80s, post-90s, young people who aspire to be the next Jack Ma, or for the matter, the next Zuckerberg, the next Larry Page. They want to try, and many of them will fail, but some of them will be successful. When the new technology that's evolving, many of them will embrace and try. And so I think what we're going to be seeing is that the combination of new technologies, the inherent size, the intrinsic size of the China market, and also the three-layer duality paradigm that I talk about, is going to provide the buttress for more innovations and more inspiration to be coming out, including in the artificial intelligence arena. I don't think anybody in China is going to say that China would want to leverage AI, or for the matter, any other technology to, quote unquote, dominate the world. I think only some Americans think that that's the case. I think the world is large enough that perhaps it will allow slightly different paradigms or different models to coexist. There may be some part of the world will follow the American way. There may be some parts of the world will follow some other ways. And that is okay. Life is just going to be okay. All right? We stay calm, right? And, you know, don't sort of repeat the same history books like, oh, when Germany and Britain were like this, therefore it must be like this. Maybe, maybe not. 50 years later, 70 years later, are we smarter or are we dumber? With more technology, are we better or are we not? You make your own judgment. Sometimes we are dumber than before. I think in many cases we are smarter. We're much more interconnected. We are much more technologically savvy. I'm here. I'm a Chinese. You don't kill me. When you come to China, we don't kill you either. So, hey, you know, let's stay calm. The world is large enough. Let's coexist. There are many things that we can do together. Thank you very much.
I completely agree. And actually, I'd like to make the case for getting away from the zero-sum AI race framing of the issue. You know, the reality is that we are much more integrated with China on this issue. You know, you think about a lot of the top talents and startups coming out of China. Well, Microsoft probably trained them or started those companies in its incubator. You have US engineers that are working in labs of Chinese companies. And at the same time, I think it is more in our interest when we think about things like setting the norms and the rules around AI. It is very much in our interest to work with China on that. There's an effort underway in China right now to write standards around AI safety and ethics. And this is something where we don't want to be doing this separately, right? That's very much in our interest. We're tackling the same kinds of questions that are going to benefit all of humanity, whether we're talking about diagnosing disease, safety on the road with self-driving vehicles. And I think that there's benefits to working together to tackle these issues much more than thinking about this in zero-sum terms.
Well, it may be very true that this should not be looked at it through a zero-sum prison. But the fact that the U.S.-China relationship is becoming more strategically competitive may, in fact, lead the two countries to be competing with each other and make this a more zero-sum game, even though I think many folks in the tech space would prefer that it is not looked at that way. Nevertheless, we're going to stick to the wording of our proposition. We're going to open it up to all of you to ask a few questions to get our speakers to clarify some of their points. So we have a question here at the front table.
My name is Michael Armeo. I run a market research firm that uses AI machine learning algorithms to better understand those markets. But yet, my question today revolves around two specific segments. If we were to narrow the area where leadership would be considered, specifically in the area of autonomous weapons and with the part of AI and machine learning that revolves around facial recognition in terms of being able to assist a surveillance state. Those two issues tend to be spoken about quite often, especially in the defense community. And if you take a look at those two issues, how would that, for the panel, either bolster your position or potentially weaken your position if you were to claim leadership or discuss the whole area of leadership? Thank you.
Okay, we'll take one more. Peter Dutton at the front.
Hi, thanks very much. There's at least been reports that there's been a pushback in the West generally, United States and Europe, on data collection in light of a whole recent number of incidents. And there's, in fact, in Europe in particular, there's legislation that limits a certain amount of data collection. And I wonder if we are underestimating the points that Mr. Tsui brought up about the importance of data collection and whether our inherent concerns about data collection might limit our advances in the West.
When Mark Zuckerberg testified before Congress and said, "Please don't regulate me," that's precisely the point he made. Is he said, "If you regulate me, you're going to give China a competitive advantage." The problem with that argument is that there actually are rules in China around what companies can do with data. Last December, China issued, I see your look, but wait a second. Last December, China issued the Personal Information Security Specification, which is a standard with very granular rules for the terms of consent, storage, use, and transfer of data. It was actually modeled after GDPR and took a lot of principles from GDPR. Now, how it's implemented in practice is a different story. These rules, I think, are beginning to be implemented with companies. I think that what the government can do with data is quite different from what companies are, but they are beginning in an ad hoc way to start to implement this standard and actually build out a data protection system. So this is an area where actually Europe and China are moving forward in actually building building out a regulatory regime around this while the U.S. is debating it. And so let's not forget that there are frameworks beginning to be put in place. Now, again, how it's implemented in practice is another story. And maybe I'll let Dr. Zuh take the question on the autonomous vehicles and facial recognition.
I think Michael is talking about autonomous weapons, right?
autonomous weapons.
Yes,
yeah.
Well, first of all, I'm not here on behalf of the Chinese government because when you talk about military, right? But nonetheless, I think we all know that in every countries and not only today, but historically, a lot of technologies were first developed for benign applications and ultimately it find its way into military or vice versa. Right, so I think that's just how governments and humankind have been operating for, again, for right or for wrong. I think in this case with artificial intelligence or any other technology, you do end up with that kind of risk. And I'm not saying that kind of risk is good or bad, but nonetheless, it is the kind of risk that we are facing. In a way, unfortunately, that's the reality of the world. And history has already shown that to happen, and I think in this case, history will repeat itself. At the same time, I think by just the nature of your question, I hope I don't get your meaning incorrectly by saying, surveillance state, for example, by using that term, perhaps you are implying that perhaps the Chinese government is really using facial recognition or omnipresence of facial recognition to make China a surveillance state. Is that also what you're implying, or am I wrong?
Given what's been reported in the news in terms of China sharing that technology,
can you give him?
Yeah.
Given what's been reported in the news that China does share that very same visual recognition technology with certain states in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, who are predisposed to using it to maintain autocracies. Mm-hmm. Given the fact that China has been known to use that type of technology, especially in managing its Muslim population in mm-hmm. parts of the country, is the reason why I brought that up. It's mm-hmm. it's not condemning the technology in general, but to your point, it could be construed, it could be used in less than benign ways.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm not here on behalf of the Chinese government. And frankly, I didn't know whatever they have done or reported to have done in exporting this kind of technology to other countries like in Africa and so on. So I actually do not know. Yet at the same time, within China itself, certainly, facial recognition is becoming omnipresent. Is it good or is it bad? And of course, I've also noticed that in America, in the Western press, there's a lot of concern about that. And perhaps in some respects, it's rightfully so. At the same time, I think one also needs to recognize that, between America and China, the two countries start with a very different base. America has been doing pretty well economically and educationally as a society is much more advanced. And you have developed a real middle class for many, many decades. You have your own value system and that works for you, right? Maybe not so much in the last couple of years with, who I'm talking about, but largely worked for you, right? China came out from the Cultural Revolution only 40 years ago. And what was Cultural Revolution? Frankly, it was a lot of BS, right? Then Chinese were totally disillusioned. China had to come from nowhere. And China had made some progress in the last 40 years. But in terms of its readiness, and in terms of civility as a society, as a country, in many dimensions, it's still way behind the advanced Western economies. And so, as an administration, frankly, in everyday life in China, we run into a lot of issues. Issues such as, a passenger in the car was not happy with the way that the driver was driving the bus. The driver skipped a stop She was so frustrated, she went over and tried to beat up the driver, and the bus fell into the river, and 40-odd people died. That happened in China. Would it happen in America? Maybe it would too, but would the probability be as high or not? Maybe not, I don't think so. But nonetheless, you do have a lot of issues. Every country has a lot of issues, and also every country have decided to take on different paths to whatever, to do whatever better governance, for whatever wrong. So I think within the context of China, this is how, at least how a lot of the Chinese are looking at it. In general, the Chinese public is not as concerned as how some of the Americans are seeing it on this issue. Is it right or is it wrong? It depends on what your frame of reference is. Today, the Chinese may not feel concerned. 10 years later, maybe they would feel very concerned. But 20 years later, they would be even more concerned than the Americans would be. So time would change, right?
Okay, great. Woman in the back, over there. Microphone is on your way. Please identify yourself.
Ray Zong, Wilson Center. From Google's AI lab in China to Facebook's colorful balloons trial, what does do U.S. companies' interests in accessing, you know, Chinese data sets, how does that factor into artificial intelligence conversations and competition going forward? Thank you.
Sorry, how was it?
Did you hear the question?
The question is in access to Chinese data sets by U.S. companies.
Their sort of search for market access and their sort of eagerness to work with data from Chinese users.
So I think that the motivation is not just data, but you know, there's a perception that innovation only flows one direction across the Pacific. And the reality is it's actually flowing both ways. And so you have Google, you have Intel, you have companies that are going into China to be involved with AI precisely to tap into the kinds of advancements that Dr. Ze has mentioned, because I think that the learning is going both ways. And it's not just about data, but it's about the kinds of business applications and techniques that Dr. Ze mentioned.
Actually, I still don't quite understand what the question is, but I think at least a couple of, right, you know, Facebook and Google are prime examples, and you know, they want to get into the China market, to get back into the China market, and to what extent they're willing to make some concessions and so on, right? I think is that a concern about the concessions that they're making?
So I guess my question was more like, do these companies have, are they able to sort of tip which way AI competition goes in their interest in accessing the China market and working with
Certainly.
From Chinese
good question then. Yeah. Now, first of all, you know, if and when they are permitted, or, you know, obviously they have to start by proactively wanting to get into the get back into the China market, and even when they're allowed, I think one of the biggest motivation for them to get into the China market is not only because of economic or short-term economics. It is actually their ability to tap into the vast amount of data that China generates. And in a way, if you stand, you know, from a standpoint of a Mark Zuckerberg Sundar Pichai, you know, the gap without the China data, the gap is simply too large for them to really to have a globally viable set of data to enable their own business model to continue to become even stronger and bigger, and so. From their standpoint, at least, it's critical that they have to have China be part of that, taking aside the morality of things, right, which is a very different issue. And so if and when they are allowed to get back into the China market, I believe that from the AI competition standpoint, or at the ability to really excel even further in AI, that will really help them a lot.
I mean, if you think about Google's mission to organize the world's data, but to not have a fifth of the world's data, exactly, that has to feed into it. And the same goes for if you fence yourself off from a fifth of the world's population in terms of servicing. I mean, how much are you a multinational company? So I think that's absolutely a driver.
More questions? Okay, we'll take one from the back. I think that's Jeff. Yes, it is, Jeff Bean. Wait for the mic.
Hi, thank you for a terrific panel. I'm Jeff Bean with CSIS. I thought Sam's point that China's lagging behind on the hardware side of the AI revolution and machine learning relative to Intel, AMD, and NVIDIA is a really important point when you start to project forward the potential outcomes. So I wanted to ask both panelists, where does China or Chinese companies stand on the indigenous hardware front in your assessment right now? And you mentioned the funding that the Chinese government has put forward on semiconductors specifically. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that because I think it's a crucial aspect of this debate and proposition.
Okay. I'll give the go first since Sam has taken the first go in the last couple of rounds. Certainly, China is as I mentioned, China is behind the U.S. in the hardware, in particular in the AI chips. But at the same time, it's not that the Chinese have nothing. You know, companies like Baidu, Huawei, and so on, and actually quite a few other Chinese companies also have developed their own version of AI chips, but just not as advanced as the American chip companies. And that's a fact of life. The Chinese are very, very much aware of that. Americans are very much of that, aware of that. At the same time, like everything else, as I mentioned a few times already, if one only take a stationary view of the world, if one only take a rear mirror view of the world, one will probably miss the trend going forward, because I think the Chinese have demonstrated in the last 40 years, in particular in the last 20 years, that the Chinese have figured out, as always, figured out some ways of making some advancements in some kind of fashion. Sometimes pretty stupidly, sometimes they waste a lot of resources, a lot of overcapacity here and there and so on, as some of the speakers this morning already talked about, but nonetheless, no one can dismiss. And in fact, this is why we're having this meeting, or the US politicians are so concerned. If China is always so screwed up, you know, and they can't make any progress, then why should you have this conversation? China will not be a competition at all, right? From the American standpoint, right? So in my view is that just like so many things that happened in the last 40 years, the fact that it was a problem for the Chinese, it became a solution for the Chinese. Because at the end of the Cultural Revolution, China was so bad. It was the pit of the Chinese history in the last 200 years. Even worse than the Opium War, the Chinese dug itself up a step at a time from the pit, and here today, this is the second largest economy in the world. It's not self-gratifying. That's nothing to do with that. The point I'm trying to make is that, you know, look forward and have an imagination or reimagination of what the likely scenario is going to be. The fact that China is way behind the Americans on chip technology, which is a reality, it doesn't mean that will always be the case 10 years from now. The Chinese may be better or maybe not as good. The China may be at the pier, maybe not, I don't know. But to assume that China will forever be behind the Americans on the core technology, I think it is a fallacy.
Can I actually ask you a follow-up question on that point?
you supposed to ask questions?
I'm going to just do it. So, you know, we've heard China talk about developing an indigenous chip industry for a long time.
Sure.
And then the ZTE ban was seen as sort of a Sputnik moment for China, where it was a wake-up call that they still really lagged behind. And we saw Xi Jinping come out and really indicate, we are going to double down and actually get this industry together.
Right.
Do you think that something's changed now? And if so, what?
Well, again, you know, I'm not here on talking on behalf of the Chinese government, but yeah.
But just in your view.
Yeah, in my view, first of all, in a way, the Chinese are a very firm follower of American thoughts. Very firm believer. Why did I say that? So what is the root cause of the ZTE episode? What's the root cause for the Chinese didn't really, weren't able to develop the chip technology? It's not, perhaps to some extent, it's because of lack of capabilities. But at the same time, it's also not, perhaps it's just how the Chinese were firmly believing in the paradigm that the Americans have introduced to the rest of the world since about 20, 30 years ago, which is called the flat world, a globalization. Division of labor across different countries. When I was working, you know, I hope you don't mind, when I was working at McKinsey and BCG, you know, 20, 30 years ago, a lot of my work was trying to help American companies to do so-called offshoring. Offshoring. We are smart. We do all the smart stuff here. Those guys are not so smart. They're cheap. Send them stuff. That was the design that we were doing. And of course, you know, you all know about Thomas Friedman talking about the world is flat. So the Chinese believed into that. And they were very busy doing the cheap stuff. And hence, Chinese get themselves into wherever they're into. And it's not that they didn't give it a try. They may have given it a try and been very, very, very successful. But at the same time, I think with the ZTE episode, with the need to really understand that, in fact, the future truly belongs to technology. And so the first way for the Chinese development is always the easy part. The easy part is what? Is we all know, and we talk about it, infringement of IPR, copying, copycat, shanghai, and then commercial applications. We are now talking about the second phase with commercial applications, and the China is really good in doing that because of the reasons we talk about. The third phase is what? It's about indigenous, you know, is the innovation, technology innovation. And the Chinese is going to double down in doing that. Will Chinese be able to do that with sort of develop a Qualcomm tomorrow? Probably not. But would you dismiss China's probability of creating a Qualcomm in 10 years, 20 years? Probably not either, right? So I think, sorry, do not discount China's will and ability to make that happen. That's what I'm saying. So.
I'm just looking for some examples. I think about the Strategic Emerging Industries Plan, which was in 2010. And, you know, how have we seen examples of marshalling state resources to boost a sector that have been successful? I'm curious to see what has
worked. Yeah, but, you know, like what you just started talking about and perhaps some of the speakers this morning, when China was committed in developing a certain technological areas, like a battery or electrical vehicles, and you say, oh, where's the China Tesla? There's no China, and I can tell you, there's NIO, there's Xiaopeng, there's Westmeister, there's Biden, which is actually not Chinese, is a Chinese-based electrical vehicle companies started by a couple of German executives from BMW and Infiniti, right? And I can name at least 10 other Chinese upstarts in electrical vehicles who are challenging Tesla. I know that this is on tape, right? So I'm going to be a little bit provocative. My view is Tesla would be highly challenged in China.
But outside of China?
No, I'm talking about in China.
And I'm talking about outside of China.
Again, you know, the world is so big, there are parts of the world which may follow a Tesla model. There may be other parts of the world will follow a NIO model, a China model. Because, in fact, we have done some analysis. If we separate the world into three worlds, China, mature Western economy, and emerging markets, in terms of mobility and electrification, emerging market will likely follow the model of China. and that's what it is. And so I think this morning and until now, I think there's a lot of skepticism and in fact a lot of concerns where, oh wow, you know, if China do this, this is scary, it's unfair, it's made in China 2025, therefore it's blocking the foreigners and so on.
Yeah.
And now what you're saying that you're not actually using
it. I completely right. agree with you. I think we overhype yeah. China's ability to compete yeah. when we either say China's going to take over the yeah, world with exactly. this technology, or we say they're never going to compete. Exactly. They're always going to be copycats.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't have it both ways. Exactly. I completely agree with you.
I'm glad that we agree on something.
Okay, we're going to take one last question, and then we're going to come back to voting. Let's take this gentleman over here.
Thank you very much. My name is Patrick Lozada. I'm a director in the China practice of Albright Stonebridge Group. My question has to do with changing attitudes and policies related to immigration in both countries and how you think this will impact innovation in fields like AI. So in the US, they're increasingly clamping down on things like H-1B visas, limiting student participation possibly in the US. And in China, you see local plans and different incentives for foreign entrepreneurs or foreign staff to come. How do you think this will impact the trajectory of innovation? And how do you characterize the respective attitudes and policies in both countries? Thank you.
And to connect this even more closely, perhaps to the proposition, will these policies help to advance China as a leader in AI? Are they going to help China or not in the long run? So who's going first?
Okay. I think that the openness of the United States has always been our competitive advantage, and particularly in the knowledge-based and high-tech sectors. And so to the extent that we begin discriminating based on national origin, whether we're talking about Chinese students or researchers or scientists, this, you know, not only from a moral, from an ethical standpoint is problematic, but from a competitive and an economic standpoint is also deeply troubling.
Yeah, I always, you know, that I do agree. I think America's strength, the real strength is openness. Its willingness to accept and embrace sort of people from all corners of the world. I mean, you guys are a big melting pot. And so, you know, I hope American administration would maintain that and sort of keep it up, because I think it is really good for America and actually for many other parts of the world. At the same time, I think on the China side, this is a point that I also disagree with Sam. The notion that China lags behind in talent, I think, is an old notion. I think many of you know that. In a way, you know, many of the students here, particularly in science and technology and so on, are people of Chinese descent and at least of Asian descent, right? Here in America, and some of them, of course, would choose to stay here after they graduate, but many of them will choose to go back to where they come from. And in fact, that's what we're seeing now, is that in China, a lot of people are returning from overseas, in particular in America, and they go back and they participate in, you know, the startups that we're talking about. This whole startup wave and entrepreneurship is really thriving in China, and the young people are really embracing that. They frankly, in China today, the young people are no longer interested, or certainly from the standpoint of employment, you know, going to work with the government, to work for the SOEs, and even the big corporates, including the big multinational, including the large American companies, is no longer the first choices of employment. Many of them would want to go to work for startups, a few friends, and, you know, just try something. And that's the whole idea. So China, in that respect, has also become somewhat of an attraction for the talent. And many of them may not be, you know, readily talented. They don't have, you know, 10, 20 years of, you know, real experience behind the belt. They may be starting off, they may be pretty green, but they get a PhD from MIT and, you know, Carnegie Mellon. They go back, give it a try, they fail here, but then, you know, after a few trials, they make it there. So that's what's going on in China. So I think in terms of that, the pendulum is swinging a little bit back to China. But yet, I hope that America will really uphold its openness and to welcome people from all walks of life, and you know, really welcome the immigrants, in particular the students who are willing to stay behind. I think that would be good for America.
Very good debate, and brought out lots of issues, some overlap, but also a number of differences. So I hope you will all pick up your clickers and vote again on our proposition. China is likely to be the leader of the coming artificial intelligence revolution. And we'll give you about 60 seconds so that you can all register your votes. There are a lot more people in the room than have voted up there, so let's see everybody register your votes. We started out with 45% saying yes and 53% saying no. So far, that gap seems to have widened. Any more votes that can register before we shut it down? Give you all another few seconds. So I think that's about it. We have 39% now saying yes, and we have, I think it is 58% now saying no. So the gap has widened. Please join me in thanking our debaters, Sam Sachs and Edward Zoe.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for coming.